Good morning, members. Now that Travis is here, I think we can get started. Good to see you. I wanted to make sure we had one more for a strong quorum. So good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Workforce, Labor, and Economic Development, Finance, and Policy meeting here. It is our first day of this week, and we still want to finish up a little bit of work that we had last time. But as you all know, we have to do a little bit of housekeeping in front of this. We need to approve our minutes. I want to recognize there is a quorum present. Representative Mecklen, have you had a chance to look at the minutes from last Thursday's agenda and looking for a motion?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I move the minutes.
Representative Mecklen moves the minutes from Thursday. Let me say the date here. I don't have it on here.
February
23rd? 20?
Actually, it should be the 21st, should it not?
The last Thursday's agenda. All those signify by saying aye. Any opposed? Minutes are carried from last Thursday. Thank you very much. Again, members, we can have Deed go to the table, testifying table. We're going to kind of continue our questioning. We still have some folks on the list. And again, if people want to add to it, we've got four names on the list yet. Representative Peter Johnson is first up. Representative Mecklen, Representative Greenman, and Representative Pinto were on the list. So again, my plan this morning, members, is to we've got three other bills to hear today, and we want to be done with this questioning by 9 o'clock. I'd like to have that kind of as our done by then, so that we have time for the bills that we're going to be hearing. So with that, Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. Just going back to the minutes, actually, just for a second. So sure. I noticed that the date on the minutes was Wednesday, February 20th. I gather that's going to be something that will just be fixed because you referenced in the motion that it was for Thursday. So maybe that's
thank
one
you.
Question.
So noted. We'll get that fixed.
Okay, thanks. And then, Mr. Chair, the second question is I noticed that the minutes, and I have not looked into this, but the minutes say that it was the minutes of February 19th being approved. So I guess was it the minutes? So the minutes from the 20th, since we just approved the 21st, do we know the minutes of the 20th are being? I was just trying to make sure we're kind of on track in terms of our dates.
So the minutes that were just approved was from, I believe, February 20th.
Thursday,
February 21st.
No, Thursday the 20th.
This is a typo at the top here. There we go.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. We'll get the dates right here. Yep.
I get it
thank
now.
Thank you for
Mr.
that
Chair.
Heads up. Yes, thank you
Mr.
very
Chair.
Much.
I understand it now.
I want to get
Chair.
This right. Thank you. All right. And the minutes have been approved as presented, so thank you for that. All right, members, again, we've got a few members on here. To the testifying table, gentlemen, Director, thank you for coming back. Assistant Commissioner Rowe, anything to open up with just to kind of get the mics warmed up a little bit? Otherwise, I think our members are ready to ask a few questions if you want to do anything, but if you want to just take them, that's fine.
No, Mr. Chair, we can just let members
sure.
get right into
that
it.
That sounds good. I'll go to Representative Peter Johnson. Questions regarding the rollout or whatever.
Thanks, Chair Baker. Thank you for being here. I did want to just follow up on I believe it was Thursday's meeting. I did bring some treats today in honor of the tradition here. I didn't bring Johnson's Bakery donuts. I came down on Sunday, so I figured 2-plus-day-old donuts wouldn't be a really good move and wouldn't give those donuts justice. But if any of you folks ever find yourself in my district and want to go grab a donut and a cup of coffee, please let me know.
Great.
I did stop by Positively 3rd Street Bakery, which is actually in Representative Kozlowski's district, just out of mine by a couple blocks. There's some delicious cookies on the end of the tables there if you are so inclined. They're an employee-owned and operated bakery and do a lot of good work in our community there. So,
thank you for bringing those, Representative Johnson.
You're welcome. Today, could you guys to just kind of go through a little bit of some of the like costs per employee and per employee for the employer and some of the different situations for businesses that are greater than 30 and less than 30? Just there was some discussion last week on this being an extreme, a big surprise for workers when all of a sudden they have these amounts deducted from their paychecks. And so I was wondering if you could just give us a little bit of a rundown on those numbers.
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson. Yeah, absolutely. So maybe just to kind of set the overall table, there's a different premium rate in the law for small employers than there is for larger employers. So if you are an employer that has 30 or fewer employees under the law, you are eligible for a reduced premium rate. So We did, the department did confirm on Friday that the premium rate for the, in 2026 will be 0.88%. So that's split, that can be split 50-50 between the employer and the employee. However, small employers, so employers with fewer than, with 30 or fewer employees, pay a reduced premium rate where basically the employer portion of that premium is half of that. So rather than 0.88, it would be effectively a 0.66% premium rate. So, and the employer can keep those savings. I'll also note that when we did confirm the premium rate, the department implemented a sort of premium rate calculator that employers can use. They can look online to get a sense of what their premium rates will be. You know, obviously, the final premium rate will depend on wage detail and all those pieces that they will submit next year. But we do have a calculator online so that employers of all sizes can start to understand kind of what the dollar, you know, dollar impact would be, whether on a weekly, biweekly, monthly, or quarterly basis.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Just one quick follow-up here. Doing a little bit of the math and kind of digging into some of the history from when this bill got passed and adjusted over the last couple of years. If the average worker in Minnesota, I think it, the stuff that I was finding is right around $67,000. The per week for that employee was, I think, $5.67. Does that sound about right to what you guys have?
Commissioner, or Director, Director Norfleet.
Chair Baker, Representative, yes, that's accurate. We're just running the numbers on the calculator behind the desk.
Representative Johnson?
Perfect. Thank you, Chair Baker. To me, that doesn't seem like an excessive amount for an employee premium to pay for a benefit like this. I know, you know, over the course of the last couple of weeks, I've had a number of constituents reach out and talk about how this benefit would impact them. One was a member from the district who is in the process of trying to have a child and going through IVF, and they're banking on this being there. They are, you know, spending thousands and thousands of dollars of their own money in hopes that they do get pregnant and are able to stay home with that child. My wife's a teacher. One of her fellow teachers was just diagnosed with a very serious medical condition, had taken all the sick leave that's available to them to try and get treatment, and now they're looking at leave without pay, reduced rates, all those types of things because they're out of time. I personally don't think that our workers and our people across the state can wait for this any longer. I don't think, you know, $5.67 for the average worker per week is too much to ask. Look forward to more discussion on it, but just close with that comment. Thank you, Chair Baker.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple different questions. On, I believe this, well, I don't know which, they're not numbered. Under the covered leave where it has the five different little diagrams on your slide, it talks about qualifying conditions that must last more than 7 days and be certified by a healthcare provider or designated professional. What is a designated professional? What fits into that category?
Commissioner or director?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'll start, and I think Director Norfleet can kind of provide a little bit of expansion. So it depends on the type of leave. So designated professional is kind of primarily for safety leave because you don't necessarily have a medical provider that would be certifying to the need for safety leave if you're talking about a domestic violence situation or stalking or things like that. You know, there's sort of different professionals that we would be accepting certification from. Medical leave, you know, naturally it needs to be a qualified healthcare provider. Bonding leave is similar in terms of that piece, but same and caring leave as well. Same is true though for active duty, right? We wouldn't require a medical certification if you've got your papers and you're going to be getting deployed.
Chair Baker, Representative, I'd also add for active duty leave, we would be relying on active duty orders instead of a healthcare provider.
Okay.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you for that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's been a lot of conversation with this program when it applies to K through 12 or higher ed. So how would this work with college students who are working like a work-study job fall under the paid family medical leave program?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so there is, you know, there is not an exemption in the law for those types, for that type of employment. Now, I would note that there still is a kind of minimum threshold that anybody, you know, earnings that any person would need to meet to be able to take leave under the law, and that's the kind of 5.3% of average wages that an individual would need to have. But there is not a, but just to state it plainly, there's not a sort of carve out for those entities under the law.
Okay.
Representative Mecklen?
You know what? I'm good for now. I want to hear some of the other questions. I may come back.
So if I could, I'm going to back at that question that he just asked too, because I've had some colleges come to me because a lot of these students are working off scholarships and they have to have work study, right? And so they may or may not be getting a paycheck because they actually their scholarships are kind of their pay. They're required to get a certain number of hours in. So whether they do have a smaller amount of maybe a pay per hour, or something to make sure that they get compensated for their work in the kitchen or whatever that might be. The colleges are asking, are those included? Because then they have to really think about how will that affect their scholarships down the road? How do they kind of realign their scholarship costs and their discounts or their ability to be giving scholarships? You're saying that there really isn't any exception for people in those kind of situations where they're literally kind of working down on college scholarship work study type of programs. If they get a paycheck, they're going to get a tax on that benefit, and that's kind of how that's working. I just want to make sure that that is clear because that's the questions that we're getting asked. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, that is correct, and I would also note that if they meet the threshold for benefits under the law, then they would be eligible for benefits under the law in the sense that, you know, college students might also, that, you know, folks in that situation might similarly have a, you know, have a medical condition or a similar item that would necessitate the use of that leave.
Okay. Do you have a follow-up, Representative Mecklen?
I do, because this is all kind of tying together. Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's programs that currently are available that a lot of people basically go, you kind of volunteer, and you accrue time or money that is then paid directly to a nonprofit. Some churches do it. They go to the big sports venues, concert venues, what have you. So the money that they earn isn't actually paid to them. It then is like sent back to whatever group is designated to. Mm-hmm. Is this all going to be factored into this as well?
Commissioner Rowe.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm not. So it might help to actually clarify what those kinds of programs are, just to make sure that I'm giving you a good answer here. I mean, we base the test though on wages that are paid to an employee, right? So, you know, I would generally think, but again, it would probably be worth to confirm the specifics of the instance. You know, if the money is not getting deposited in this individual's bank account, then just based on how you're describing it, I wouldn't necessarily think that that would qualify as wages, and therefore I would think that it wouldn't qualify for premiums or that they'd be eligible for the program. I imagine the specifics may vary though.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mecklen.
So basically they are paid by the hour, but they're not paid directly. They designate whatever nonprofit, I guess for the lack of a better term. Like it can be a church. Mm-hmm. It can be an organization that does things. And groups of people will go volunteer. It happens. I should know this actually better because my better half does this. And she actually just worked at Monster Jam Saturday or Sunday it was. And then the money, in this case, it goes towards college tuition.
Okay.
For the daughter. So, but it is based on an hourly. It's a minimum of, and depending on how well that particular concession stand may do, some do it. I have a friend that does it for his church, who they're part of the security team at concert venues. But it is by the hour, but it goes to not necessarily them, but they do accrue and bank all this time that equates into money. But the question would be, do these organizations doing this then have to account for this additional program?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, again, I think that this kind of depends on just like the definition of wages that's contained in the statute, right? So, you know, so I think I honestly maybe we can follow up and it would be helpful for us just to kind of help us understand what the exact nature of this payment is. Again, wages in UI, generally means that it's paid to an employee directly, or I don't, and I shouldn't even say the word directly. It means they generally they have to be paid to the employee. So if it's going through an intermediary on behalf of a beneficent organization, I'm just not sure that that would qualify. But again, I think there are, you know, there are complexities, and we'd be very happy to work with you or any of the organizations on that just to clarify those issues because we want to get it right.
Representative Greenman. Oh, pass? Okay. We had you on the list before, so that's why we're asking if you were still. Okay, sounds good. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you so much to the testifiers. I was, several of us were talking that as this was coming up today, I knew where my head was last week, and then there's been this break, Mr. Chair, and so trying to get my head back into it. But I was flipping through the presentation and just really appreciate the work that you've put in to have to stand this program up for Minnesotans and what a benefit it's going to be. I guess I have a simple question, which you've kind of already answered, but I want to ask it again just to be sure. Will the program be ready on January 1st, 2026?
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Pinnell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I guess maybe just a comment. We heard a bill, and actually it ended up passing out of committee, to delay this program before having heard about the program. We've now heard about the program. It's a little bit of sort of we shot first, we aimed later, and it turns out that our aim actually was pretty far off because actually – I mean, this is fabulous as I'm looking through this. You've got all this detail. You're putting a tremendous amount of work in. And Minnesotans are really desperate and eager for this program. So I thank you so much for coming in and for walking us through this. I do wish, Chair, that we'd sort of done it the other direction and had this walkthrough because I wonder if that might have changed folks' perspectives, maybe people's votes on that bill to delay. And I do hope that we'll be able to kind of pull that back because this is a really important program. You put a lot of work in, and I'm really, really excited to have it get started. So thank you, Chair, for having the folks in, and thank you to the testifiers.
Yes. So thank you, Representative Pinto. And again, I was in the room when they said they were ready to launch MNLARS 2. They had fancy presentations. We looked at both commissioners in the eyes. They said we're ready to go. And again, I also want to say that I appreciated the offer to come and see the operations. If we want to do that, we'd like to be able to maybe run through a few testing of this. I'd like to be able to kind of see it. I think, again, we are the ones ultimately responsible to let it go. I know that the law has passed. If nothing does change, if the delay doesn't happen, but it is upon us to make sure that we are doing everything we can to make sure that there is no disruption in this program and the process. I have one more question, but a couple of questions that I have as well, too, and then we can kind of wrap this thing up. The paid family program, so anybody, well, let me ask you this. What is your estimate, maybe this is to the director, what is your estimate of sort of claims the first month that this kind of rolls out in 2026? Do you expect a bit of a bubble from rolling over from things in 2025 to affect 26 launch, director?
Chair Baker, yeah, out of the gate, we do anticipate higher volume in January as an initial bump of 2025 children are able to, or new parents are able to take leave for their children born in 2025. That bump is temporary, but we are averaging around 10,000 applications or 10,000 approvals each month. It should be higher in January and then get back to normal after that.
So you're kind of estimating about 10,000, give or take, claims a month, maybe higher, though, the first month, but you're thinking around 10,000 claims on average?
In that neighborhood.
Director.
Yes.
Okay. Did you want to say something, Commissioner Rowe?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I was also just going to mention, you see, you generally out of the gate see kind of higher family, you know, kind of a higher rate of family claims, so kind of bonding leave claims, you know, kind of catching up with the backlog of births that you've had. Medical leave claims generally take a little bit longer to ramp up.
Okay.
I would say that's another experience in the state. So there, it doesn't quite, it sort of evens out, but you're still going to have a kind of a busier first month.
So again, kind of to the operations again, too, maybe this is to the director. When you've got a loved one who is needing care from a family member, could be a senior citizen or someone who needs care, and they have a lot of people who want to care for that individual, do they get to have, does the system allow several members of a family to care for the same person? How does it work for caring for a loved one from multiple sources? Would they all have the ability to take the time off? Is there sort of a rule to say that, well, you know, he or she is getting plenty of care with the main caregiver, but if we have too many, it's kind of using the system in a way that not it's not intended to do? Director?
So, Representative Baker, there are legitimate reasons why somebody may need more than one person caring. In my own life, my mom is a cancer survivor, and my sister and I took turns caring for her. In the law, the way that we're working to make sure that the leave is medically necessary and sufficient to care for the person is that the medical provider of the person who is receiving care needs to provide the medical certification that the care is necessary from the person who is providing the care. So if more than one person is providing care to a loved one, they need to get the healthcare provider certification from that same healthcare provider. So the doctor is the one telling us that the leave is medically necessary and that the care is medically necessary.
All right. And my last question, I think, is the definition of the family definition, that word. How will the portal administrator sort of determine the leave applications that fall under the broad definition of the individual who has a personal relationship with an applicant that creates an expectation or reliance for that applicant? How do you sort of, you know, work that definition? You know, it's not a sibling, it's not a blood relative. How do you define that in when you're approving these kind of things? Because this language it's very broad, Director.
Representative Baker, again, it does rely heavily on the certification of the healthcare provider. As we mentioned last week, though, we also do have involvement of the employer as a extra checkpoint to confirm. If there is anything that's brought up that the person does not have that relationship, we will investigate.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Wayne Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few, hopefully, quick questions. But one of the things I had question, and definition of a tax or benefit, I know I've been brought up many times, this is a benefit. To me, a benefit is something that you choose or opt into. Something you do not choose is a tax. This is a tax because people are not choosing to opt in. And if they have the opportunity to take it, it may turn into a benefit, but there's many people, and in fact, the calculation is a majority of people will never take this. It's the only way it calculates out to work. So I see it more as a tax than a benefit. But you mentioned that 400 people you're hiring 400 people. How many as we've all talked, you know, on this committee and other people and other departments and other people are still struggling to find employees in this state. How many employees do you calculate are going to be necessary to be able to handle this going live on the 1st?
Commissioner Roll.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that's the number. We're targeting a staff of 400 employees in a variety of kind of uses, call center, product, claims adjudication, those kinds of elements, and that's what we need to run the program going forward.
So,
Representative Johnson. Sure.
So if like everybody else, you're not able to staff the way that you feel it needs to start, and you only get 300, 350, 375, are you going to not move forward because you don't have the proper staff to move forward and possibly leave people without the benefits that they're counting on?
Commissioner Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I mean, as I think we said last week, we're very much on track in terms of hiring. We've been getting really strong interest. We've been, I think, hiring, we've had really high quality candidates. That being, and I think we always try to have contingency plans so that we'd be ready, that we'd be ready to go under any circumstance. But I feel very, we feel very confident that we'll have a fully staffed team, well in time for the program's launch.
Any follow-up, Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, yeah. So you basically feel that you have a program and a place to work that nobody else has that will make sure that you're the go-to place that people want to go to. I do have follow-up. Who sends the money to the state? Is it the employer's responsibility then to send the money to the state? And how often are they required to do that?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yeah, so it's Employers submit the wage detail and tax returns kind of via the unemployment insurance system. That's done on a quarterly basis. So an employer will submit kind of wage detail records that outlines for that past, basically for the preceding quarter, for each individual, how much did they work and how much were they paid, and then they will submit a quarterly payment to the department.
Representative Johnson, follow up.
Just one more follow up. I know last time we met, we discussed the price or how much the tax would be, and you said at that time you looked at each other and kind of figured out, do we know? And then I know a couple days later it came out. How were you able to come up with that number from the point that you didn't know for sure to that you were confident or able to put out so quickly?
Commissioner Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so I think the number that we confirmed was in line with the actuarial analysis from last session. We did want to roll out kind of the communications that we had confirmed the premium rate with a variety of useful tools for employers, like the calculator, that can help employers sort of calculate potential, kind of estimates of premium costs. And we wanted to make sure that we had kind of all that content ready to go. So really, it was a confirmation, I think, of items that had been largely debated in the past session, but we wanted to make sure that everything ticked and tied and that we had useful tools for employers to be able to use.
All right. Thank you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and appreciate this discussion. And I know Representative Johnson, you're new here, but DEED has done incredible work, for instance, during the pandemic with unemployment insurance. Folks have been short-staffed, but, when we're short-staffed air traffic controllers and we don't stop flying planes, we're short-staffed firefighters and we don't stop fighting fires. And what we know about this agency particularly is, like Minnesotans relied on unemployment insurance, and they did the work, oftentimes short-staffed, in a way that provided for folks. I think that you can be confident in the services that they're providing, and on this committee you'll get to know a little bit more. The other piece of this is modeled after unemployment insurance. So it is both a tax and a benefit, but it's a social insurance program, like unemployment insurance, like Social Security, like Medicare, things that people have relied on for the last, in some cases, 90 years, like Social Security, to provide for themselves, their families, and have a way of life. And so as we think about this is actually an old concept, not a new one, and it is implying that both the tools and the experiences we have. We've had a couple of long set of conversations since I've been here. We've been talking about this bill. I was elected in 2020. I know that I think the first time we passed it, looking to you Representative Pinto and Chair Baker, I think that the first time it passed on the House floor is 2019. So I think a lot of these pieces just retread the same conversations. I know that since we have had DEED in here last, we've had a week, but there have been two bills that have been introduced to just eliminate paid family medical leave, and that, I think, from our conversations about the delay, was one of the concerns of our party, which was, and from this side of the room, was that it wasn't really a delay. It was mostly just a delay to kill it. I know that that's not where you are at, Chair Baker, but I have seen the bills now introduced to do that, and I'm wondering, are we going to hear those bills? Is that a conversation we're having about just repealing the program, or are those just bills that were introduced that we won't hear?
Representative Greenman, I think that was a question sort of directed at me, which is great. I think there's a lot of other ideas still floating. I know that there's some new ones that are coming out in the Senate right now that actually might have some bipartisan support that we're kind of looking at, but we'll see where that all turns out again. What a lot of us have heard is that around the state of Minnesota, with your large attending groups out there, there's a lot of concern about this program. It's a lot of things to absorb and understand. It's a tax on a lot of people that a lot of people don't know about what the tax really is yet. They see the benefits. It's a popular program. We want to make sure if it rolls out, it rolls out well. And it rolls out well to all sizes of businesses and partners that have to be part of this program in order for this to work. So, again, I am proud of the ability that this committee needs to do to sort of make sure that this is bulletproof. We're going to keep asking the questions because we've been through too many failed systems that have not gone well. And we need to make sure that we drive that home. And I want to come back to your comment earlier about it's a lot like unemployment insurance and Social Security stuff. It's a socialized insurance program. This is different. This is wholly supported by the state of Minnesota and the taxpayers of Minnesota and the businesses of Minnesota. Unlike Social Security and unemployment insurance, that we have a backup plan. If we run short, we have the federal government to sort of step in and help us get through that without having a big shift in our rates. The only thing we can do here is to take it back to a higher percentage of our payroll tax. I'm just, there's a difference there. This is the first time this has been done on this level in the state of Minnesota. So I just want to make sure that we're doing our diligence to make sure these things are talked about. And yes, you will hear in the next coming weeks ideas about how does this work for all sizes. All, you know, we're trying to get to some of the questions about colleges and some of the uniquenesses of this. How do we handle that, you know, that line in the bill where, again, the family definition can be kind of, it's squishy. It's not an easy thing to fix. The director, you know, you talked about the caregiver has to be certified to be able to do that. That, those kind of questions help us understand what they are supposed to go through. But we've also had other states that have had problems with this, where some are getting double dipping with unemployment insurance alongside a paid family. Other states haven't figured this out yet. So we need to make sure that our state is ready to go with this. So follow up, Representative Greenman.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Baker, and I really appreciate that. I actually see Minnesota's program being self-sufficient as a benefit and a security, especially now. Now what we're seeing at the federal level is Elon Musk rifling through Social Security accounts. We are seeing programs being cut or frozen willy-nilly. Yesterday we had a press conference where we had domestic violence organizations, survivor organizations, who shouldn't have their resources frozen but can't get their resources all over the state are talking about closing. I don't think unemployment insurance is safe from that. I think there's a different conversation that would be helpful to have about the impact that DEED and DLI for that matter, but I think DEED probably is more impacted by the shock of having a federal government that is not potentially the partner that they have been. But in this case, with paid family medical leave, we have set it up, and when I'm looking at it, you know, for a small business, $2.83 a week to be able to provide this benefit, whether or not the federal government, whether or not President Trump decides to honor the commitments that we've made to folks, to Minnesotans, to Americans, we can do this here. And I agree that I think in the rest of our budget and the rest of the conversation, we actually need to have a conversation about what it would look like, what it looks like for the federal government not to provide the resources to DEED and other things. But in the PFML, in the paid family context, because we don't have a federal partnership, we've actually figured out how to make it work here with Minnesotans. And to me, $5.67 is a real thing out of people's paycheck, but it is a benefit people get if they don't get that. They're talking about weeks and weeks, like my sister took, unpaid. And so I think that we have designed this program so that, one, in Minnesota, we can take care of Minnesota workers, and I'm actually very proud of that. So I agree with you that if there are specific problems, right, if we're hearing from specific small businesses and there are tweaks that we can make, I think everybody is open to it. So far, a lot of what I've heard is taking away benefits from people or cutting people out, and I don't think that that's in this moment something we should be doing. So thank you. I appreciate it.
Final member questions. Representative Johnson, Wayne Johnson, a quick follow-up, and then Representative Bakeberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know something that really concerns me now and makes me wonder really if it's ready to come out is a comment was made about the unemployment insurance and how it worked. I can tell you during COVID, it did not work. It basically was shut down for employers, and basically it was we're not interested in hearing you from as an employer, whether somebody quit or somebody was fired or whatever like that. You could not get in. You could not put in requests online. It was just get the money out to whoever claimed, got the money, and it was just sent out. Now we're experiencing right now what that policy did. The experience rate has doubled. We also have an extra excess rate on that. And so my concern is if you're not, don't have the employees available, It'll be just send out the money to whoever requests it, and there will be no way to actually see if people should be receiving it. And so comparing it to the UI, especially around COVID, makes me even more concerned that it will not be ready to go. Thank you.
Representative Bakeberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to get back to kind of the purpose of these guys being here and the implementation of paid family medical leave. In my education world, we talk about that as a learning target to kind of focus what I'm thinking about in the conversations. And Representative Greenman actually talked about some specific concerns, like what are some examples of specific concerns that employees and employers are bringing up. And I want to kind of dig into one of those. One of the specific concerns that I've consistently heard specifically from school districts and those in collective bargaining agreements is around the split. And Commissioner Rowe, or Assistant Commissioner Rowe, you talked about, you said earlier that it can be split. Okay, can you, and then my understanding within the law is it says that the employer must pay 50%, so no less than the 0.44. So is it part of the collective bargaining that school districts, counties, cities have to negotiate that? Or are you saying that it is already split?
Okay. Assistant Commissioner Rowe.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Bakeberg. So as far as what the paid leave law says, right, is that employers may charge, you know, up to half of the premium to their employees. They can choose to charge, you know, they can choose to charge them less. The law does not go into great detail on collective bargaining or contracts because you know, I think each collective bargaining agreement is unique, right? And I don't think the paid leave law would presume to sort of interpose itself with kind of the contractual dynamics of PELRA and other aspects there. But you know, from our read and understanding of the law, right, that, you know, an employer may choose to charge up to 50% of the premium to their employees. But, you know, we don't know. We don't have visibility into what, you know, every single kind of collective bargaining contract around the state has, what provisions it may have, you know, kind of contained about how new items must be bargained, et cetera.
Follow-up, Representative Bakeberg.
So if I'm understanding, just to provide clarity, because this is a specific concern, if there's nothing in the collective bargaining contract specifying a split for paid family medical leave, then the employer can say that they are going to pay 50%.
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I want to be careful because I am not the one at the negotiating table, and I don't have, you know, visibility into what the contracts say. What the paid leave law does say is that employers can split up to 50% of the premium overall. And actually, if I could just add one just quick thing. Last week, I think you'd mentioned just kind of concerns from districts overall. I did want to emphasize that we've done a lot of outreach to districts, and I just wanted to provide a few examples of some of the entities that we did have really, I think, productive conversations with, just to be responsive to your question last week. You know, back in October, I think we met with the Association of School Personnel Administrators and State Negotiators, the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, NASBO, the Association of School Administrators, Association of Charter Schools, the School Boards Association. I think we had, you know, 416 attendees, join us for that, you know, for that meeting. And I think just in December, we met with the Association of School Personnel Administrators and State Negotiators for some of the larger districts. So we have been getting really, I will just say, we've been getting really good engagement from those folks, and obviously seek to continue to clarify those points, those salient points.
Rep. Bakeberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're getting good engagement because there's a lack of clarity, and those people are trying to figure out what's going on. That's the reality. And I just want to, I'm going to use Representative Johnson's numbers, and I'm going to round down. So just to walk through, you know, it's been mentioned that this will cost the employee about $5 a week. So about $10 a pay period. 26 pay periods a year, so it'll cost the employee about $260 a year. Okay, so for some people, that's very doable. For other people, that's concerning. When you shift to the school district side and you run those same numbers for a district of about 300 employees, which is a, you know, medium-sized district, run that through $5 a week, $10 a pay period, 26 pay periods, about 300 employees. That's about $78,000 a year this is going to cost school districts. School districts don't have the option to just levy. So they have one of two options in order to balance their budget. They can go out for an operating levy, which they have to get the voters to approve that, or they can reduce expenses. And, you know, I had the opportunity to meet with the school district, the Duluth School District recently, and St. Louis County Days. And if I'm remembering right, they shared that they're cutting about $5 million. Their district is much larger than 300. So we have to recognize that districts are faced, school districts, I'm not even talking about counties and, you know, and cities, but this is a cost to the employers and employees, and it is going to have an impact on the budget, which impacts workers. So, you know, one of the districts I represent is cutting $4 million, and one is cutting a little under $1 million. This is part of that equation. And the reason you're getting so much engagement is because there's a lack of clarity, which brings us back to questions about implementation. And I appreciate that you're saying that we're ready, but I wasn't around when Chair Baker, when Minlars was, yep, we're ready to go, and it wasn't ready. So we have significant concerns about that. And, I mean, this split is just one of those examples. So thank you.
Final member question, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not understanding I just want to say I'm not understanding the confusion around the split. The base is 50-50, then there could be negotiation around whether or not employers will pay more of that 50-50 split. I think that's very clear, and I think it's clear in the language explicitly, so I'm not sure where that confusion is coming from. But, Mr. Chair, if I can, I'd like to ask a question to the director and the deputy commissioner. We talked a lot about that this is a – we've heard a lot of – characterization that this is a one-size-fits-all program. I would like for you all to describe how that is actually not the case. There's an exemption process. There are exemptions for certain employees. Can you speak to those things?
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Frazier. Yeah, there are a few different, there are definitely a few different elements I think that would be responsive to that question. There's two big ones for small employers that I think I would probably start with. The first is the reduced small employer premium rate that I think I mentioned at the top of the hour today, which is essentially employers with, you know, 30 or fewer employees pay a reduced premium. Basically, they can deduct about half of the employer share. They don't have to pay that in terms of the overall premium. We also have small employer assistance grants. So this came up a little bit last week, but this is assistance that's available to small employers who are trying to, you know, who if they have an employee that goes out on leave, they are able to, they can get a small grant from the state that can kind of help them hire new staff, provide a kind of a premium pay, a differential pay, so that while somebody is out, they can have staff who are kind of help to backfill a little bit on a temporary basis until the employee makes a full recovery and returns. Additionally, as you note, there is an exclusion under the law for certain seasonal hospitality workers. So, component of the law is that seasonal hospitality workers, essentially entities that derive a substantial portion of their business from seasonal hospitality work in hotels, et cetera, can apply to the state for individual exemptions, assuming that the individuals in question are. Are only seasonal workers. They're not going to be kind of full time ongoing staff. What else am I forgetting?
Director
Baker, or Chair Baker, Representative. I'd also add that we do have an exemptions process that we're going to be going live with this spring, where if an employer has a plan that is at least as generous as what the state is offering, they will be able to provide those benefits either through a private carrier or self insured through their own. Administration. Additionally, we have the ability to interact with employer plans. So we have a concept in the law called supplemental benefits, where an employer could choose to designate certain payments to an employee, whether that's through their own plan, their PTO, or other payment that they make to an employee during the course of the absence as a supplemental benefit to make up the difference between partial and full wage replacement if they choose to do so.
All right. Follow-up, Representative Frazier.
Thank you all for sharing. I'd like to emphasize that this is not a one-size-fits-all. There are off-ramps here. So thank you for clarifying that. And just lastly, I wanted to speak. There was a comment, Chair, if I may, there was a comment around our insurance, our unemployment insurance program. And I'd like to say that that program was working because I had to represent multiple individuals on the appeals process that were denied claims that they were submitted. And then ultimately they were approved for those claims. So the program was working. Folks were still getting rejected when they applied. And I also would like to note that we know that also the program was also catching fraud. So it was, again, we have one of the best in the country, and it did that during – it performed in that manner during COVID, and actually it kept a lot of people afloat during that time. So I just wanted to put that on the record.
And to that, again, thank you, members, for this robust conversation. Back to the UI comments, it has been noted, too, that there was full of fraud. After COVID was over, it was in committee. The OLA certainly identified a number of millions of dollars that went out for a lot of different reasons that we did not catch, and that we weren't the only state, but there was It was a sloppy program at the end at best. Not to say Minnesota didn't execute a lot of things well. We did. But I want to recognize we could have done things better. And I think what I see this program rolling out, and again, this one-size-fits-all, which I have said many times, what we're talking about is there's a couple of exceptions here and there for small employers for a little discount on the payroll tax, things like that. But what is overarching for just someone like me, and then we'll move on, is this program of paid family medical benefit from any company right now that would have been offering this program would have been probably the richest in any company in the state of Minnesota. It's a big package. It's very, very generous. Up to 20 weeks in any company would be huge. And now what we're doing is we're going to bring this on every single employer in the state of Minnesota. It's a unnatural thing that we've got to get our heads around because it is mentally not able to kind of work with a lot of folks in small businesses that have never dreamt of a program as robust as this when we are just trying to make sure our employees have the flexibility to come to work, have the ability to get paid really well per hour. This is what this is. It's the reality of a one-size-fits-all because everybody will get the same benefit at the end. And we have to know our workforce is already strained. We don't have enough bodies behind our retail clerks and the retail counters. So we need to make sure that we continue to bring ideas to this committee this year, which I intend to do. And, again, I just want to say I appreciate Assistant Commissioner Rowe, Director Norfleet. Thank you for coming, and we'll be in touch very, very soon. So I want to thank members for the conversation, and we'll move on to the next item on our agenda. So thank you so much. Thank you. First up, we'll have Representative Hicks. If you can move forward with your House file 661, if you want to move to the testifying table.
I'm going to try to have some recorded testimony.
Okay.
So I'm going to try to hook up the line.
Sure. Go ahead and hook that up, and we'll let you go. When you're ready to go, just give me a thumbs up. I am going to sort of just also get you set up for with your amendment as well, Representative Hicks. The chair will offer an amendment or move the amendment to your bill, an author's amendment. Do you want to talk about that first, Representative Hicks, and then play the video, or do you want to play the video first?
We can talk about the bill first, Chair, if that's okay.
Sure. Go ahead and just describe the bill with the amendment as I have moved it, and go ahead when you're ready, Representative Hicks. To House File 661.
Thank you so much, Chair, for the opportunity to speak on House File 661. I'm excited to be joining your committee today to talk about the innovative program that's proven very successful in southern Minnesota. As many of you probably know, Rochester is home to Minnesota's largest private employer, the Mayo Clinic, with over 51,000 Minnesotans employed today. This program, known as the Bridges to Healthcare, initially launched in the Rochester area and has expanded throughout southeastern Minnesota to include Albert Lea, Austin, Faribault, Owatonna, Red Wing, and Winona. Bridges to Healthcare is a public-private partnership that helps non-traditional students transition to a lifelong career in healthcare, Minnesota's current largest industry. These careers provide a livable wage, benefits, and help meet the workforce needs we all know we're facing today. Many of the students and graduates of the program are non-traditional students, perhaps older in age, first generation, use English as a second language, or other things that create unique opportunities for them to enter our healthcare field. This partnership program provides a pathway and support to students to gain the experience and the education in order to pursue professional training and available certificates and degrees. Examples of possible roles include things like certified nursing assistants, patient care associates, phlebotomists, home health aides, administrative supervisors, and registered nurses. The program received $750,000 each year in the last biennium from the Workforce Development Fund. And due to ongoing success and expansion, this bill seeks to maintain that level of funding and continue our expansion efforts and the great success that the program has demonstrated. To share more about the program, I have some in-person testifiers and some virtual testifiers. In your packet, you also have a fact sheet that will give you some more information. And the amendment that I have just clarifies that we're not using any of these funds for space or infrastructure.
So with that, Representative Hicks, I want to make sure that we make a motion. Again, the chair moves the amendment to your bill. Members, any questions to her amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Your bill is amended as presented. So thank you, Representative Hicks, for that. And Mr. Mullins, are you ready? Is that what you want to do next, Representative Hicks? Okay, Mr. Mullins, welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for allowing me to speak on behalf of the Bridges to Healthcare program. My name is Kyle Mullen. I'm the Adult Services Director with Workforce Development Incorporated, serving southeastern Minnesota. We are the convening contract and administrative agency that oversees this program, but its success is achieved through a partnership with multiple community and technical colleges in our area, as well as adult education providers. So currently we sit with approximately 4,500 open RN vacancies, 2,500 open nursing assistant vacancies. DEED itself acknowledged that the long-term care industry is one that is going to need significant help and attention over the next few years due to demographic and economic shifts. And we're currently sitting with an over 10% vacancy rate for those crucial fields. The Bridges to Healthcare program offers us a window of opportunity, answer to that challenge. So this program, it was started several years back in 2011, started showing initial success, and conversations began in 2019 to expand it. It was approved by this committee in 2023, and I am here proud to present that not only have we since then expanded to 8 counties in our region, we've also taken the original targets of supporting 300 students per year that would not have been able to enter the healthcare industry otherwise. We've left that mark in the dust. We're already over 300 for this year and projected to hit 420 for this biennium. And on top of that, this program, the $1 million that it takes to fund that expansion and operation, as Representative Hicks indicated, is a public-private partnership. 25% of our operating funds come from private sources. It's also important to note that 80% of our students who graduate are from culturally ethnic or ethnically diverse backgrounds, and 60% go into that long-term care industry that I just mentioned is a priority for focus in the coming years. This program offers a rare triple win, win in economic self-sufficiency for the students, often able to support their families and get off of public assistance. It is a win for the healthcare industry that is grappling with an intense workforce shortage, and it's a win for the tax base, enhancing the communities and incomes therein. Together, that combines for a very powerful economic boost for our region.
Thank you, Mr. Mullen. Any further testifiers, Representative Hicks?
I'm going to try really hard to use these electronic testifiers.
Okay.
I have a husband who is disabled, and it was very difficult for me to be able to have anything more than a job at a gas station or things like that. So I was working 3 jobs, 2 part-times and a full-time, and running myself ragged. trying to figure out how we could pay for his medication, but we were not going to be able to pay for food. And I ran into someone that I worked with, and she told me about the Bridges program, about how they would help me to pay for school. They would help me to get my classes. They would work with me on the schedule. They would work with me on extra things, you know, just the gas alone. I live 30 miles away to get to school. You need help getting to class? You got a flat tire? I can help you with that. You guys were always there anytime that there was a roadblock, you know, and the times that you didn't think that you could and that you just wanted to give up, you know, and I can't thank you guys enough for that. I'm not where I want to be on my career path, but I'm at a great start. I can work, make better money, work less. I'm extremely grateful. I'm extremely grateful.
And side note, until I got these video testifiers, I didn't know who it was. And if you are from southeastern Minnesota, you'll understand how funny this is. Of course, one of the video testifiers is a friend's cousin, because that is southeastern Minnesota in a nutshell.
Hi, my name is Rebecca Sullivan. My journey with the workforce development started whenever I applied to Riverland for the LPN RN program. I am very grateful for the workforce because they have helped honestly through everything from covering my shoes and scrubs to the class fees to helping me through a really tough time in my home life and covering my rent expenses and provided stability during a tough time by helping me with other resources around and helping me with find diapers, wipes, food, anything that I've needed for my kids. You guys have helped. So I am very grateful for all the opportunities that you guys have given, and I just hope to be able to return the favor one day. So I don't know what I would do without the workforce, that's for sure. Everyone here.
Very good. Representative Hicks, is there further more or further video?
No, I think we're ready for questions.
All right. Member questions. Representative Zalesnikar.
All right. Okay. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Hicks. I think this is a great program. My question with the 300 that you have in the program, is the placement rate for them accepting jobs the same number, or can you talk a little bit about that?
Mr. Mullen.
Yes, thank you. A majority of the students do end up entering into employment as well as continuing their education simultaneously. Of that 300, I don't have the exact numbers, I can get those for you, but I would say over 95% are going to be either continuing their education or entering into employment. As I mentioned, 60% of that 300 are going straight into the long-term care workforce specifically.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Hicks. I think this is a fantastic program in southern Minnesota and expanding, and anything we can do to provide health care support for the workers, really, and for patients coming in to receive the services they need is wonderful. So I think it's innovative what you're doing, and thank you for the presentation.
Thank you. Any further member questions? Again, I just want to have a final. Oh, go ahead, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and Representative Hicks, thanks for this. I love just the combination of addressing the workforce crisis in healthcare and providing opportunity for folks, just all of it. One small question is Bridges to Healthcare itself like its own entity? Because it looks from the documents like maybe it's the Workforce Development Inc. that is kind of the parent. If you could just talk about, I'm thinking a lot and talk to the chair a lot about kind of how to structure our use of workforce development fund dollars and just having conversations and just wondering about that with respect to this one.
Mr. Mullen.
Certainly. So Workforce Development oversees the Bridges to Healthcare program, and through that program, the funds are used to pay for training for supplies like you saw, scrubs and shoes and items like that, or other barriers, you know, flat tire and such. It also pays for the career counseling folks that provide the support of walking through other challenges or supports they might have. A lot does go towards the tuition that comes for the training provided by the community and technical colleges and adult basic education providers.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if this, I think if we did end up advancing this as a direct appropriation as written, I wonder if maybe just something, Representative Hicks, you can talk with House Research about whether it maybe would need to be structured to make it very clear exactly who's receiving the funds from DEED. Because if Bridges to Healthcare is not its own kind of entity, we'd want to make sure. I know we're quite a few steps away from that, Chair, but just something to look at. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks again, Representative Hicks.
Thank you very much. Representative Mueller.
It's been a while. Thank you, Mr. Chair, since I've had my name confused with Mueller and Mueller.
Mueller, yeah.
Now that I'm no longer with the Mueller's committee. Yeah. Representative Hicks, this is an area that Riverland contributes with and is such an asset to our area. We have seen how the benefits of public-private partnerships and how this is supposed to work. I mean, the only way that we're going to be able to continue to expand our workforce and to kind of negate crushing debt that we see with our students is through these partnerships. And so hopefully you just got an alert on your phone that said Mrs. Mueller added herself to the bill. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Representative Hussein.
Thanks for coming and forward for this great bill and work first and creating opportunity. I have a follow-up question. What percentage do you think it's enrolled for second language in this program?
Representative Hicks.
I know it's a large number, but I would be lying if I tried to do it, so I'll look to my testimony.
Mr. Mullen.
I can provide you the specific numbers for the number of participants who have English as a second language. I believe it would be in the 55 to 60% range, but I'm happy with the exact numbers too.
And how are follow you
up,
reaching out?
Follow up, Representative Hussein.
Thank you. How are you reaching out? I know, Representative Hicks, you have a large new American in your district, and workforce is one thing that we lock off an opportunity. And are you engaging that community and making sure that they are know this is such a wonderful program, it exists?
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair. Well, I want to say we have a lot of new Americans in Rochester, but my colleagues across the aisle in their southeastern communities also have a lot of new Americans from different communities. And so it is a priority, I think, for all of the representatives in southeastern Minnesota to make sure that we're making those connections and reaching out to those communities. For specific strategies, I'll turn to Mr. Mullen.
Mr. Mullen.
Thank you. So Workforce Development offers a wide variety of different programs, including a number that are targeted towards individuals who are new Americans or English as a second language learners. So in addition to supports there, if we come across somebody who this program matches their needs or their interests, we do share that with them. Due to the years this program's been running, honestly, those communities have got the word of mouth going quite strongly. We have marketing materials available, but even in some of the videos we showed today, it's going strongly through word of mouth, and we're exceeding the enrollment targets. So the word is out in southeastern Minnesota.
Good. Thank you for your bill. Representative Hicks, final comments.
Thank you all so much for allowing me to come and present a little bit about this wonderful initiative that southeastern Minnesota in such a positive way. I appreciate your time, and I hope that as it is laid over today, it remains in consideration for the final bill.
Thank you very much for bringing House File 661 forward. As amended, we will carry this bill over to for final or for further consideration in another bill. So thank you for your testimony today. Members, next up, Representative Davids is here with House File 610. I'll have the chair move forward with his testifiers. Welcome to the Workforce Committee, Mr. Chair. and presenting House File 610. Please proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. And I'm not sure if someone from the department is here, but I think we need to make a couple quick amendments here. I got an email from a Joshua Moore. Oh, Joshua, no more?
Josiah.
Oh.
Josiah.
Josiah. So I'm going to walk through this, and if I'm doing good, just leave me alone. If I'm not, let me have it.
So, Representative Davids, are we going to have to do an oral amendment to this bill? Because I don't have anything that has been presented to us.
Right, and I don't know what your rules are.
Pretty tough rules here.
See,
we can do an oral amendment if we need to, but I just want to make sure that we don't have anything in front of us.
Okay.
Right?
Yes, and this
one moment.
I just
hang on,
this.
Mr. Chair, hang on.
It's tripling the amount of money.
Sounds good. Thank you. Okay, if it's just tripling the money, we don't care about that. That'll be fine. Yeah, no. No, but to all seriousness, we're going to lay the bill over anyway so we can still make changes to this bill as it comes forward. So
okay,
I just want to make sure that's on the record.
Let everybody know what we're talking
yep.
about here briefly.
Thank you.
So on line 1-1, we'd strike apprenticeship and insert career preparedness. On line 2.5, we would strike and entering into the apprenticeship program and insert and receiving emergency medical responder or emergency medical technician certification. So we can work on that if it's okay. So I think just changing a couple terms so we're kind of up to date on where we need to be with the department. So we'll work on that. And thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your indulgence. House File 610 is an appropriation, $300,000, to go to the school district of Houston, number 294, to beef up emergency medical services training online. And I have the superintendent here, and I'm honored to have Mr. William Carlson, a senior, who I believe has been through the program. So at this point, I'd like to turn it over to superintendent of schools in Houston, home of the mighty Hurricanes.
All right, welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and please proceed.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mary Morum, Superintendent of Houston Public Schools and also Minnesota Virtual Academy. So those of you who I've testified before, this is an addition to a pathway that we've already kind of emulated. So we've already done this. We're on year four of another pathway that we've kind of done the same background and bones for. So just so you know, if you want to look at other we've done this. So as you know, I'll tell you the story. So I started as superintendent 4 years ago. 4 years ago, a retired teacher came into my office and said, "We our ambulance service is going to have to close. Would it be okay if I talk to your teachers?" And I said, "You bet. Come on in." So at that point, he recruited three teachers from our staff to become medical responders. From that, the medical responders turned into one of our teachers becoming a paramedic. He's on sabbatical right now, but he taught a course and offered this through Houston in school, in our brick and mortar. We have the capability in emergency medical responders to reach all counties in the state of Minnesota. Some schools already have emergency medical responder courses, and they're doing things very well. But there are some schools that are unable to provide this training to their students. What this does is the money comes to us, but then we would issue it back to your home district. So as all you sit here and you all have your home districts that you represent, the money would come back to you. We offer the training, and you can become a certified technician. Afterwards, we have a paramedic. We were not a licensed, when we started, we were not a licensed Houston in our small town was not a licensed testing center. So we partnered with Winona, and Winona tested William, and that's who, but we have since become a testing center, and we do have a person on staff that can come to wherever you're at in Minnesota and help test your students out. So it's not just a pathway of taking the online, but actually having the certification when it's done. So that's kind of my story. The need, the why, is always we very well know that we're down close to 50% since the pandemic of our emergency medical responders in the state of Minnesota. There is a huge need, and what better way to catch them when they're still in high school and find out something that they're passionate about and provide that opportunity. So that's what we're here to do. And no one's going to tell the story better than a student himself that is actually active and involved in it right now.
Welcome to the committee. I assume it's Mr. Carlson. If you could please introduce yourself and tell us your testimony. Yeah, and pull that microphone in. That's better. Perfect.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is William Carlson, and I'm from Houston, Minnesota, like she said. And I'm a senior in high school. And my journey kind of started 2 years ago when my teacher, Mr. Momsen, asked me if I wanted to ride along on the ambulance crew. And that meant I was on call with him and had my own pager. And so whenever we'd get a call, I'd go with and watch how he did things. And that's how it all kind of started and how I learned and became passionate about being on my town's ambulance crew. And since then, I've become certified as an EMT. And through that journey, I found that emergency medicine is something that I want to pursue in the future with the hopes of becoming an emergency room doctor. And the kind of the defining moment when I found that out was like my first cardiac arrest call. And it was really hard to deal with. But, you know, through overcoming that and helping save somebody's life, I found that that's something that I want to do in my future.
Mr. Carlson, that's a great story. Thank you for sharing that with us. Anything further, Mr. Chair, before I take it to member questions?
Yes. Well, I'll wrap up later. So we
okay. Questions from members? Representative Pete Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Thank you, Representative Davids. My question is just a little bit about the program itself. I've been an EMT for, I think, a little over 25 years, trained as a paramedic. A huge portion of that training was the hands-on portion of it, something you can't really do through an online or virtual academy. So what is the pathway for those students to get those hands-on skills, which are so critical to this type of work? You know, is that partnerships with local agencies for their ride-alongs and clinicals, and as well as the hands-on training portion before you go and do those? So just if you could address that, Superintendent, that'd be wonderful. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Superintendent Moran.
So this is new in starting, and there's people since we are coming in before you that say, we will be your partner in northern Minnesota. We will be your partner. So those things need to be worked out where we're going to do those hands-on, but also having that person on my staff that can come and spend time with you wherever your school is located is how we're going to counteract that. But I think, and I know you're divided into regions, you know, just like we are for athletics, there's certain people that are going to be that located central, and we have to develop those partnerships. And just from this being in front of you today, people have already started reaching out to me. We will be that partner for you, knowing that that is the need. If we can provide the teaching and the training, then the hands-on, we're going to have to find those locations all over the state.
Representative Johnson, any follow-up? Thank you. Representative Pinto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And so, yeah, maybe building on that, just trying to understand the geographic reach. Is this something where, assuming that, I mean, could school districts all around the state reach out to you, and sort of what might be the capacity about kind of how far you could reach with this grant or beyond?
Superintendent Moran.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
All right.
We can reach the whole entire state. Right now, we're in 88 counties. Our virtual academy covers the whole entire state. Those testing locations and those hands-on, we're going to have to, and we have partners that are in this room listening to us here today that are already ready to help me with that portion of it. I think that we are going to have to look at education differently in the future. There is a shortage. There's a need for workforce development that's why we're here. So how do we look at education differently, and how do we provide that base and then that hands-on component? Is there further questions? Sorry.
Lee Pinto. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then are there other career pathway opportunities for emergency medical responder, emergency medical technician certification around the state? And partly I'm trying to fit each of these and the Cheryl Noakes conversation we've had, kind of each of these specific requests into kind of more broadly how we can address the broader concerns. Are there other emergency medicine pathways that are available around the state?
Superintendent Moran.
Well, I like when I started at the beginning, there are schools that are already doing this, right? So they're doing it at their – so this is for those schools that maybe don't already have that built up.
Okay.
To me and Mr. Carlson and I were talking about on the way up here too, this is if emergency medical responders also you think about firefighters and law enforcement and all the other things, or someone like William who might be interested in pursuing it as a medical doctor, all the different things that this can lead into. It's a good base for all of that. I think that that's a really important. But yes, other districts have things up and running. We presented this fall, you know, kind of that outreach. We're trying to get out and in front of public, like, how can we do things differently? And I would, a school district came to our table, and their aha or their takeaway in their rural district in northern Minnesota, they're like, we are offering the program, but we don't actually have the students going out on call. And so from that conversation, they're like, that's our takeaway that we're taking back to our district. So just telling our story, we're just very passionate about having opportunities for kids that they couldn't normally be or be part of if they don't have the staff. So providing that opportunity for them.
And then final
follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so then to Chair Davids and to the testifier too, I think one thing I would find helpful is as we begin to move towards putting a budget together is would be if there are sort of letters of support or other things from other places, I'm trying to, as I say, think about how we can get beyond, you know, we pick a specific program in a specific place. I probably should ask Representative Hicks a little more about this and that last bill. But if there is something where, in fact, this is really a resource that's going to become a statewide resource, that's pretty exciting. If there's information you can provide or testimony or support just in these coming weeks, not to put a lot of extra work, but I think that'd be very helpful as we're assessing this. And I thank you, Chair, and thank you to Chair Davids.
I can answer you just quickly. So right now we have 26 students in this semester, right? So our first bunch was 9. Out of those 9, seven of them passed the test in our EMR and like William going out on calls, and William has taken it another step, right? So that's always the hope that you take it another step. But we have 26 this semester as well. And that's just not even with coming in front of you, those are just our students at MNBA. We haven't reached out to any other districts. That's just 26 in-house. So, and we cover, just so you know, like I said, we're in 88 counties, like our students are in 88 counties. So,
Representative Bakeberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Baker. Just a question kind of logistically about maybe Mr. Carlson can answer this, but from the student perspective, if you're a student that's not enrolled at Minnesota Virtual Academy, how does that work to enroll in the class? And maybe I'm misunderstanding, but, you know, how do you get enrolled in this program if you're not a student at Minnesota Virtual Academy?
Is that question to the superintendent?
Yeah.
Okay.
Either one, yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
William's like, you can answer that. Mm-hmm. So any student, so the how state funding works is we are part, you can take any class, whether it's this class or any sort of class. Your school district just reaches out. We enroll you in that one class, two classes, whatever it is. And that money comes directly, so how the funding, which I know you know, follows that student to us, but then after the course is over, then what this bill would do is allow that money to come back to your home district.
Representative Baker?
Yeah, if a school district wanted to offer this pathway, they didn't have a local way to do it, they can partner with Minnesota Virtual Academy, have that part of their course catalog.
Correct.
And students can sign up, and then that aid goes with that student for that portion of the student's day. They may be a full-time student at, you know, XYZ school district, but they're taking a class, this class, through Minnesota Virtual, so that funding would go to cover that cost with that student for that time. Am I understanding that
yes,
correctly?
Yes, and then it would come back to that district after the course is completed.
Okay. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Baker, and thank you. I think you and I have a history, and so one of my very first years teaching, I taught her daughter in Blooming Prairie, so here we are. your comment about how we have to think about education differently, and Mr. Chair, thank you for indulging me in just one moment. I really believe, Chair Davids, maybe this is something we could bring in front of education, because this is something that as we think about education differently, how do we expand on apprenticeships? Chair Pinto talked about how we could start, instead of doing individually, how do we tackle this problem as a whole. Mm-hmm. And the way you do this is to open up more opportunities like this. And what I mean by that is I had a different school come in front of me telling me about their EMS program, and I asked them if this was eligible for like a science class or a health class or another required class like as an alternative, and was told that it was not, that this had to be done as an elective. And so if Mrs. Moram, if you could tell me, is this something that a kiddo could use for an elective, or is it something they could use it as a different class like a science or health class?
Ms. Moram.
Thank you. Yes, it's up to local decision. If they take our course catalog, if they look at the description and they decide whether they want to offer it for a health course or an elective, that is up to local decision making, and they can bring it forward. And any district that would want to see, you know, the course description can certainly reach out to larger districts. That, you know, it has to go in front of a couple different committees before it comes to the board and then approved on. So it just depends on what your local school district will allow.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you so much, and Chair Baker. And that's really good that, to be able to see that a local school could do that. I know that MDE in the past has kind of stood in the way of some of those. And so if we come across any of those type of things, this is great for workforce, but I'd really like to see this in education to make sure that we have a clear pathway so that our kiddos can be able to use that. Thank you, Chair Baker.
And final member question would be Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to the author, I love this. We're lucky in Burnsville to have a really robust pathways program within the walls of our high school. And so I always worry about, because I have my own kiddo, who I call a non-traditional learner, but I feel like we're at risk of losing students, because they feel like four-year degree is just not for them, but they don't know what that means in terms of alternatives. And so when we have these pathway programs that are hands-on or even virtual that expose them the way that our student here was exposed to it and kind of came up with a whole new life plan based on the experience, that's incredibly important. So I'm really grateful you're bringing this forward. I do have a question. Because it talks about starting on line 1.17, must provide outreach to and encourage participation in its programming by students of color, indigenous students, students from families with low income, et cetera. I appreciate that. So that leads my question to be, when we have students that are perhaps First Americans and they have language barriers, have we addressed within the program having multiple different languages as part of the curriculum so that we are really including and embracing all students and providing a pathway for them to learn through either their own language or some sort of comparable translation services?
Thank Superintendent you. Morin, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So yes, we have computer programs that speak in multiple different languages and everything can be translated. We are very diverse within Minnesota Virtual Academy already, so this is something that we deal with through all of our programming, not just this programming. So, and then also finding, you know, people for the hands-on, then we have translated, we hire a translating company no matter what the language is, so then that hands-on component, we could send people to help with that portion of it as well.
Representative Berg?
Yes, thank you. That is wonderful. Thank you so much.
All right, no more questions to the bill author. Representative Davids, final comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My work with EMS and firefighters goes back to when I first entered the legislature in 1991. At that time, there was no EMS pension, there was no EMS board. Those two things are, and many others, are a result of Representative Roger Cooper, former representative from Bird Island, and myself. He was a Democrat, I was the Republican. We'd bring a bill in, the Democrats would rip me, the Republicans would rip him, and then it would pass unanimously. Our bills, and it was kind of sport almost. But former Rep Cooper and I were able to get some, well, the pensions, the board, and so forth. Now, these are volunteers that we're talking about at this point, but you could be training to be a full-time person, too. But going back to the days of O.J. Doyle and under the capable leadership of Buck McAlpin at this time, we're looking for different ways to get more EMS boots on the ground. That's what we're trying to do. The 2017 tax bill with Chair Rod Scoy and myself, We put some things in the tax bill to incentivize people to take EMS training. We couldn't go statewide with it, but we went various parts of the state. So this is something I've been working on for a long time. We look back the last 2 years with Chair Pawlowski in the higher ed, where he was, we were designing things to have tuition paid at a VOTEC or a college for EMS training. We are short. Every year I go to the Tri-County Firefighters and EMS in Rushford, and same story every year. We need help. We need help. We're going to have to shut down. We're going to have to merge. We're going to have Mayo take over. All these types of things. Well, we want a robust EMS service in our small towns. And when I saw this, I went, oh my, this could really be something. We need to get these folks trained, get them when they're juniors and seniors in high school, and hopefully they'll take that throughout the rest of their life. So I know it's going to be laid over, unless you just kill it here. So we'll let it go through the process.
Yeah.
And thank you so much for your time, members.
So to that as well, Mr. Chair, I want to make sure that the minutes reflect that we still want to have some amendments that are going to be brought forward to us in writing before this gets considered for later later bill. So just want to make sure that we will thank you for the hearing for House File 610. It'll be considered for later a later bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Thank you, testifiers. Nice job today, Mr. Carlson. Nice job.
Thank you.
All right, next members, we've got our final bill up for the day. We've got about 20 minutes. We've got two bill authors today, which is a little unusual, but we've got a very special project we want to bring forward, and both Representative Reimer, House File 606, and Representative Wayne Johnson, House File 1376, almost duplicate language, but we want to make sure that we give them both a chance to kind of speak to this bill, and you guys can get situated. I think both representatives will kind of have a statement and a preview, and then we'll turn it over to the Father Project. So welcome, Representative Reimer, to our Workforce Committee. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. Really honored today to talk a little bit about House File 606, which is an appropriation for about $2 million as a grant to the Goodwill Easter Seagulls for the Father Project. And this is the same grant that that we did in 2023. As I come down to St. Paul here, it's my first term, but we don't agree on a lot. I think one thing that we can agree on is the importance of a dad. And I am a dad, and it's one of the most important jobs I think I have. The pressure that you face is pretty heavy, but the reward in seeing your kids grow and thrive and become stable members of society is really important too. So I think we can all agree that when fathers are actively involved in their families' lives, that we're all stronger for it. It builds better community members and creates stability in our society. So right now, unfortunately, too many children in Minnesota are growing up without the presence and support of a father. The data is clear. Children raised without a father are 5 times more likely to experience poverty. But this isn't just about statistics. These are real kids who are facing real life, and doing so with a father makes life a little bit easier. So I'm proud to support the Father Project. It's a nationally recognized organization right here in Minnesota that is changing lives and strengthening families. Through key partners in Rochester, St. Cloud, Minneapolis, and St. Paul, this program provides targeted support to fathers who want to be present, responsible, and engaged for their children's lives. But they often face significant challenges in doing so. Now, some of the services that are provided in the Father Project are case management, parenting support, child support services, father and family activities, so you know how to interact with your child. Oftentimes, when a father is removed from a situation for a long time, it takes a little bit of coaching to learn how to be an effective father, and that's what this program does. Now, I'm a marketing guy. I work in digital marketing. And there was a recent study that had happened from the Wilder Foundation about the money that we invested in 2023, which showed the long-term financial impact of this investment. For every dollar that we invested in the Father Project, we were returned in productivity $3.41. So a 3-to-1, 3.5-to-1 return on investment, I would get hired over and over and over again. if we could provide that type of return in any type of program. So with that, I'm here with Representative Wayne Johnson, who has some companion legislation. I think this is really important for us to take up, lay over, and consider for further legislation. But with that, Representative Johnson, I'll turn it over to you.
Welcome to your committee, Mr. Johnson. Representative Johnson, please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you, Representative Reimer. Also, thank you, Representative Johnson, for getting me off the hook for today anyway, for not having treats for my first bill that I brought forward. So, as Representative Reimer had mentioned, a lot of it, this is a great project. As an employer, I have found one of the biggest obstacles for success is issues that may be happening at home. And that is both for the mother, the father. If there's issues going on at home, they are not having their full mind on being successful when they're working. This is a great project that helps in the situation where fathers want to get back involved with their family. This is a situation where if the mother agrees, or the parent, or the guardian agrees, the father has an opportunity to better themselves and get back involved with the family. That can provide a lot of success for both ends. I've had many situations where that has not happened, and that is the main reason they have not succeeded. And so this provides a great opportunity for them to come in. It's not expanding government. It is about investing in the program with a proven track record. And it was mentioned earlier, the study that the Wilder Foundation. This bill builds on a successful model, ensuring that more fathers across Minnesota have access to the resources that they need to be present, engaged parents, strengthening families, strengthening communities, and proud to support this effort. This bill is really a big, is well-rounded, that it takes into account all the skills that you need to be successful. That is just not about getting back involved, but what are you learning and what are you prepared to do and learning about doing that. So that's why I think this is a great bill. The difference between the two bills, I believe, is mostly how the money is allocated. Representative Reimer's is the first, all of it allocated in the first year, mine is separated between the 2 years. But with that said, Mr. Chair, members, I would like to, unless there's any questions you want to do right away, I'd like to hand it over to one of the testifiers, Andrew Freeberg, the Father Project Program Director.
Yeah, if your testifier could come forward, please join us at the testifying table. Mr. Freeberg, welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and please proceed.
Good morning, Chair Baker and committee members. My name is Andrew Freeberg. I am the Director of Family Stability Services at Goodwill Easter Seals, Minnesota. I have led the Father Project side by side with numerous partners since 2001. What began as a small program in North Minneapolis has evolved into a nationally recognized responsible fatherhood program, a powerful intervention to ensure that Minnesota dads have every opportunity to support and nurture their children. Thank you to bill authors, Representative Johnson, and Representative Reimer for your support and leadership regarding fathers and families. For over 100 years, Goodwill Easter Seals Minnesota has provided workforce programs to eliminate barriers to work and independence. Our Father Project serves dads through a combination of employment and parenting services. We integrate job coaching and placement, parenting classes, child support management, and wraparound services. We have shared our proven model with partners, Family Service Rochester in Olmsted County, Goodwill Easter Seals in St. Cloud, and other locations. As has been stated, most fathers want to be involved with their children, but many need to develop tools and a support system to succeed. We help dads get jobs, train for better jobs, and move into careers as they become positive, productive workers and parents. We serve primarily low-income, non-custodial fathers facing multiple barriers to economic stability. Dads engage voluntarily for the sake of their children. As you can see in the overview provided, we serve a broad mix of dads, and our outcomes are strong. The Father Project has demonstrated, again, as has been stated, a strong return on investment. With continued funding, we projected that in the upcoming biennium, we will enroll 450 dads across the state. place 250 dads in new or better jobs, engage more than 400 dads in parenting classes. We are grateful for the legislative funding we received in the current biennium. Your investment has helped strengthen the Father Project across Minnesota, and we urge you to prioritize resources for the Father Project. There are few, if any, similar services in the state. Given the current budget situation, we know this is not an easy ask, but it is crucial to maintain level funding so services can continue to meet the needs of fathers and their families. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Freeberg, for your testimony. I'm sure you'll be around for questions if we have them from members. Further testifiers, Representative Johnson or Reimer? Yes, please come forward. Good morning and welcome to the committee. I was going to try to introduce yourself for you, but I couldn't get your last name. So please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee. That happened to me in the Senate, too. So
yeah. Thank you.
My name is Bo Joroge. Currently, I'm a father engagement coordinator for Father Project in both the Olmsted and Dodge counties. And we work through Family Service Rochester. But I actually came to the program as a participant. So my family moved here in 2020 in the middle of the pandemic, and I was divorced a year later, and a serious decision that I was facing was moving back to my hometown of Las Vegas and parenting from afar, 1,600 miles away, parenting my three sons. But I got connected with the Father Project, and I got plugged into the community resources to be able to stay and be a present father. And so me and my sons are going to benefit from that support for generations. And now I get the pleasure of extending those supports to others. So I want to give you an example of a dad that we're currently working with. His name is Sam Cook. When he came to us, he was homeless and he was working part-time. He and his co-parent, they were struggling to work out legal custody and parenting time issues. And his time working and looking for work was spread too thin to make any significant changes. So when he started working with us, we helped him secure a second part-time job. He was able to get some housing with a roommate. We worked with him on budgeting so he could start saving for a single-family home. And he and his co-parent actually started meeting with us to work out the custody issues instead of paying all that money and going into the debt, going into court and things like that. But as he was making progress, he actually was terminated from one of his jobs after about a year due to a background check. So instead of helping him go look for a second part-time job again, we actually reviewed his resume with him. We came to learn that he had previous experience as a medical assistant. And we talked about his hesitation in pursuing that career field. And we actually helped him practice interviewing, beef up his resume, and go try again. And so I'm happy to say that he's currently working as a medical assistant again. He's earning more. He has more consistent work hours. He has employer-subsidized health benefits. He spends more quality time with his children and his family. And he models that healthy communication and collaboration with his co-parent in front of his kids, so providing that example for the future. So I just want to say that my family, his family, and the many others that we work with, we thank you for your continued advocacy and investment in us. In our parenting groups that we offer, we always talk about how it takes a village, but we don't want to just keep coming and talking about it. We want to have, you know, practical support and steps to make that a reality. So I thank you for your investment so that you can help us go out there and get to work.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Jorgen. George, thank you so much. Member questions? Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. I was actually involved with this program, I think, at the very beginning, like, I don't know, it was 20 years ago. I'm not exactly sure exactly when, but I'm a big fan of it and loving the involvement of parenting in it. Had a question for the two authors, I guess, is that I noticed that I think it's Representative Johnson's bill contains the language about community reentry following confinement, that being one of the goals, which I love. I mean, that's great. That's a group of fathers we want to especially provide support to. And just wondering about the distinction, is that something that Representative Reimer is okay with? Or if we can just sort of understand that. I noticed that same phrase was in the handout about referencing coming out of confinement. And just want to kind of understand that.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you for that, because again, it's a little, this doesn't happen a lot when you have kind of a co-producing. They're not exact bills, but they're very similar. Yep. To either author, if you want to address the question from Lee Pinto.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. I would say, generally speaking, I plan to sign on to Representative Johnson's bill as well. I'm comfortable with the provisions. And, you know, when we talk about reentry, that's also part of getting people to a place where they can create family stability. So I believe in that.
Okay.
Thank you. Anything further?
I do, yeah. Thank you, Chair. And then the other thing is just that as we're, and you would have heard the prior bill as well, as we're moving towards trying to build a budget, it may be that we're emphasizing more competitive grants as opposed to direct appropriations. I think you're aware that's been one of the discussions that's been out there. And so I guess I'd encourage the bill authors maybe, and happy to talk with you about, is there either an existing grant program that would fit well, or is there a change to be made to programs or a new program or something? This is such powerful work, and not to say that that's not where, Chair, we may end up having a direct appropriation, but at least if we didn't, it'd be nice if so we can do some thinking now about how to make sure that this work continues. The work of having dads and having parents be supported can continue. We can have those conversations. I really encourage you to kind of start that thinking now in case that is a direction that we end up going. And I also just want to call the testifier that it's appreciate hearing about your journey, and presumably it makes you that much more effective in your work now, having been a participant. And so just thank you so much for that work. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, thanks for bringing them. Okay, thank you very much, Representative Pinto. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Baker, and I guess this is more of a question for you. I know that as we were looking at different nonprofits, we were also going to be able to look at their 990s, and mm-hmm. So I didn't know if we had, and I was trying to look online, and I think the most recent one I found is from 2020 or 2021, and didn't know if we were going to be able to find and look at some of those things.
Yeah, to that question, we're going to try to get as many of those to the committee members as these are presented forward. Our staff in the background will try to get that to us as well, but we want to see where that is at. We'll kind of look at that as we kind of mark up the final bill with all of our potential grantees, and again, whether we do it as sort of an RFP process or not, that's yet to be determined by how we're going to sort of wrap up our final bill here at the end. So we'll always look at that. I don't see any more further questions. Final comments to the testifier, to the authors.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just again, appreciate everyone's time here today. And this bill, I think, is something we can all agree on. And to Representative Pinto's point, I'm certainly happy to have conversations about what this could actually look like. I will just say the effectiveness of a program, if we want to measure it by that, a third-party audit giving you a $3.50 to $1 return on investment sure seems like something worth investing in, and we're investing in families and fathers. So thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I don't want to add much other than the fact that we have a program here that has shown has worked and has made a difference in people's lives, and that's something that we should continue to invest in. Thank you.
Representatives Reimer and Johnson, thank you for bringing this bill forward. It's a great project. I have also worked with this before, too. Again, thank you for the hearing. House File 606 and House File 1376 will be laid over for possible inclusion to a future bill. Thank you very much for the testimony, and that'll wrap up this discussion about this bill. Members, looking at tomorrow's agenda, Wednesday, we have a couple, two or three presentations. We'll hear from the Bureau of Mediation Services. We'll also have Explore Minnesota Tourism here, as well as the Department. No, let's see. Misclassification. Thank you. And we also have one bill tomorrow as well. We're going to be hearing a bill that kind of came in late from the Education Committee. So, members, we got a busy day tomorrow. With that, we are concluded with our work today.